Hey, all you trekkers and trekkies and pop culture fans, this is John Delancey coming to you from the Q Continuum, and you are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Hello and welcome, one and all, to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. And you are in the lair. So glad you are here today. Big anniversary this year for us sci-fi fans. Yes, it is. 30 years ago, Star Trek The Next Generation premiered. I am celebrating all year long by chatting with some of those talented folks who brought the 24th century into our living rooms each and every week back in the day. Now, recently, you heard from Tony Todd, who played Worf's brother Kern on the show. Now, even a couple of episodes ago, Diedrich Bader, Batman himself, one of his first acting gigs, was on board the Starship Enterprise. We talked about that. Today, a very special guest from the world of Next Gen will be here. He helped start it all in that very first episode. He was there at the very beginning. He was there at the very end. He popped up in Deep Space Nine and Voyager as well. He even co-authored a novel and comic book based on his character. The character, of course, is Q. The amazing actor who brought the malevolent maker of mischief to life, John Delancey. He will be here momentarily. Great show on tap for all of you out there today. You're going to love this one. Quick note before we get started, though. As many of you know, I originate this show from Columbus, Ohio. Hope you're listening to this episode close to the premiere date. And if you're in Ohio and doing that, in just a matter of days, two very cool events will be taking place here in Columbus. Remember, way back on episode 34, for some of you longtime listeners of Comic Book Central, I interviewed Mystery Science Theater 3000 creator and star Joel Hodgson. Very cool conversation that. Well, in the first event that I mentioned that's going to be taking place next week, Joel and the cast of the new MST3K, they're going to be touring the country this summer with a live version of the show. When I interviewed him a few years ago, he talked about that might be a possibility. It's on Netflix now. They're going to be touring with a live version of the show now. They're going to be here in the capital of the Buckeye State Wednesday, July 12th at the Davidson Theater. Don't worry, you won't have to remember everything I'm going to be telling you right now. I'm going to put all of these things in the links, links to these things in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. So I'm going to throw some information at you, but don't worry about having to write it all down and remember it. If you go to comicbookcentral.net, you check out the show notes. Everything I'm about to tell you is going to be in there. So if you check out the site, you get that information. Again, Joel and the cast from MST3K in person Wednesday, July 12th at the Davidson Theater. You can find out more about the tour itself at mst3k.com/tour. Tickets are available at kappa.com. It's C-A-P-A.com. That's for the Columbus, Ohio show. The second event I want to tell you about. The following two nights, Thursday, July 13th and Friday, July 14th, it's going to be Mystery Science Theater Week in Columbus, Ohio. The Mads are back. More live movie riffing with Frank Conniff and Trace Beaulieu from the original MST3K. They are also taking their show on the road. It's called The Mads Are Back, as I mentioned. They're going to be at the Gateway Film Center here in Columbus, Ohio. Information on the tour. TheMadsAreBack.com. That's where you check that out. Tickets to the shows in Columbus, GatewayFilmCenter.org. Again, all these links are going to be in the show notes for this episode on my website, ComicBookCentral.net. So everything's going to be there. I will say this. I've been in touch with the Misties who are touring, working on recording some chats, obviously. I'm hoping to bring them to you right here in Comic Book Central. We're going to see if that's going to work out. We'll see if we can get the scheduling to work out. Don't have anything confirmed just yet, but stay tuned to Comic Book Central on Facebook and Twitter next week. You're already there, but I'll throw these out at you. Hopefully you're following on social media. Facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. Don't forget the network. Twitter @ComicBookCTRL. If I can make it happen, you'll know about it first on Comic Book Central's social media pages. Again, if you're in the Columbus, Ohio area, get your tickets to those shows now. If you're not in the Columbus, Ohio area, they're going to be probably coming to a city near you. So check those websites out. But you know how funny these folks are. It's going to be a great series of shows. All right, from silly sci-fi to serious sci-fi, or as serious as Q gets. He did appear in a mariachi band on the bridge of the Enterprise, right? It was kind of silly. Look, I'm tapping into the Enterprise computer for a little bit of background on my special guest today. Check it out. Then, straight from the Q continuum, the man himself, John DeLancey. John was born in the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, raised in the Keystone State. He attended Kent State University, won a scholarship to Juilliard, and pursued an acting career in Hollywood. In the 70s, he landed several guest shots on shows like Police Story, Barnaby Jones, Battlestar Galactica, and he showed up several times on one of our favorite TV shows, The $6 Million Man.
Steve, your arm.
It's okay, Irina. It's the one that can be replaced.
Can you move it?
I can't move it. I can't feel it.
You better let me take a look at that arm, Colonel Austin.
It's all right, medic. It's just a scratch.
Oh, don't try and be a martyr, sir.
That won't be necessary, medic.
Well, sometimes infection has a way of setting in, you know?
As listeners of this very show know, John went on to appear on the daytime drama Days of Our Lives with none other than future Harley Quinn, Arlene Sorkin. A few years later, John took on the role that would make him a legend to sci-fi fans, Trekkers and Trekkies all around the world, the enigmatic, omnipotent being Q on the very first episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Thou art notified that thy kind have infiltrated the galaxy too far already. Thou art directed to return to thine own solar system immediately.
That's quite a directive. Would you mind identifying what you are?
We call ourselves the Q. Well, thou mayst call me that. It's all much the same thing.
The character of Q became so wildly popular, he was brought back for nearly every season of Next Gen to continually menace the crew of the Enterprise. And John also got to take Q onto the Star Trek spinoff shows Deep Space Nine and Voyager. He co-authored a Q-themed Star Trek novel with Peter David called, appropriately enough, IQ, and an issue of DC's Next Gen comic book series as well. Now, over the years, John has appeared in numerous feature films and television series like Breaking Bad. More recently, he's gone behind the mic to voice video games and animated series like My Little Pony and Justice League Action as Superman's nemesis, Brainiac.
I, Brainiac, claim Metropolis for my collection. Congratulate me. You're my 10,000th city.
Continuing my celebration of the 30th anniversary of Star Trek The Next Generation with the Enterprise crew's greatest adversary, the man who is Q. He is John DeLancey. John, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for being here and happy anniversary. Happy 30th anniversary.
I remember it well because it also is my younger son was born. Patrick Stewart and I were rehearsing lines when my son was, quite literally, but on the day, actually, when he was born. So I always can say, oh, yeah, that was 30 years ago.
Okay, so it was like May 87, I think you were shooting Encounter of Farpoint, right? So, I mean, it's almost 30 years to the date.
Yeah.
That's insane. I mean, did you...
he was born May 16, so...
Wow.
Yeah.
It's the show we're still talking about. It's on Netflix. All new generations are checking out The Next Generation. Gene Roddenberry himself, the great bird of the galaxy, he told you as much back in the day, didn't he?
He said, you have no idea what you've gotten yourself into. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And here it is, 30 years later, I'm talking to you.
Yes, you are. Okay, so you were not, it's a safe assumption you weren't a Star Trek fan going into this, right, then? Because, I mean, like, you would have known the phenomena that was Trek.
Well, yes. I mean, I knew the movies. I was not a TV watcher, and I am not to this day. I knew the movies. I loved going to the movies, and I went to the Star Trek movies. Okay. But I was not what you would call a big fan of Star Trek. It didn't mean that much to me.
But you did like sci-fi back in the day, correct?
I very much liked sci-fi. I was a kid who had a difficulty reading because I was dyslexic before people knew what that was, And my first book when I was probably around 11 or 12 was that I read from cover to cover was Jules Verne's Mysterious Island. And that was my introduction to science fiction on a literary level. I went on to The Wells and all that stuff. But I certainly went to all of the movies constantly. You know, this was also a period of time where you could leave home at whatever, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, or during the summer, I should say,
yeah,
and not come back until dinner time. And so my friends, we would meet at the little theater in Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and we'd go to the movies. And the best movie was a science fiction movie. Second best was a war movie. And that was it. Those were the two types of movies that we
do you recall, like,
for. Oh, and a horror.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, that kind of the horror sci-fi kind of crosses over too. Did you recall like anything specific? Like, did you like the giant creatures, you know, from space? Because like the ones that kind of combine horror and sci-fi.
Yeah, the first one that I saw was I'm going to get the name wrong. It came from outer space.
It came from outer space. Or, yeah, yeah.
Was that the one in which the kid is in the he wakes up and he looks out the window and the flying saucer comes down?
Oh, you got me googling now. Let's assume that's the one, because that obviously had an impact
on
you.
And then worst. I mean, the worst possible thing that could happen is that you're, you know, along with the fact that everybody in the town is turning, you know, weird, is that your parents get the thing zapped in the back of their neck,
yeah,
you know. And I remember seeing that with my friend Spike.
His name was Spike?
His grandmother, Spike, I know. His grandmother took us to the movies. I'm 9 or 10 years old.
Oh, cool, Grandma.
And I white-knuckled my way through that. I mean, I was terrified. And at the end of the movie, he wakes up and you go, oh, thank God. Oh, my God. It was a dream. And he looks out the window and a flying saucer comes down. I freaked.
Aren't those the best?
I ran out. I knew that the level of tension was so high that I could not, as far as I was concerned, it was all going to happen all over again. And I ran out into the lobby and just waited for them.
Nice. Oh, it was a whole different world back then. Well, okay, so sci-fi kid, you're reading these things, but your father, Philadelphia, Oregon, you grew up outside of Philly, right?
I grew up in Philly until I think I was about 7, and then we moved out to the suburbs, yeah.
Okay, so your father was an oboist for the Philadelphia Orchestra?
He was. He was the solo oboe player for the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Okay, so did you have an interest in classical music at that point? Like, how old are you at this point where you realize what dad does for a living, and any interest at all in that, or was that just kind of like that music just was a little foreign to you?
No, it wasn't foreign to me at all. I mean, I went to a lot of concerts. I've gone to more concerts than most adults will have ever gone to. So I would meet my friend.
Not Spike.
His parents were not Spike, another friend, who I just actually just talked to this morning, Lewis. Okay. And we would be dropped off, and we'd go across the street to the automat, and you know, we get something to eat, and then we come in, and because my father would go to the concerts about an hour and a half before curtain, and so we just, you know, we just palled around at the Academy of Music there. We went downstairs, and they knew us. So the men backstage, and then, you know, the stagehands would take us down and see the well. And, yeah, we just sort of hung out, but also listened to a lot of music. Mm. I mean, you know, because you had to sit there quietly and listen to a two-hour concert.
How old are you at this point?
Oh, I started doing that as early as one could be taken to the concerts.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So now I'm interested in this too, because you're obviously, you get into the TV and movie world. What did your father think of like orchestral music for movies and television? Or was he just like a purist?
I'm sure that he was a purist. I mean, just knowing him, he was a purist. But he also, I remember him making comment about the fact that there is so much fabulous music out there already. Why aren't they using more just classical music to do, for movie scores? But
to incorporate the music. So he loved like the Lone Ranger and using like the William Tell Overture and 2001 and stuff.
Well,
like that.
Yes, yeah, right, okay. Right. I did take him to see 2001, and I said, "You've got to hear this music. I mean, this is fantastic music." And boom, 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 boom. And he just turned to me and he goes, "Well, that's Zarathustra. What's the big deal?"
John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, like, did he enjoy any of that?
Korngold was the one who started essentially the main, theater music. And I don't really know what the answer is to your question about whether, how he felt about certain, most film music is okay, and some of it is fantastic. Orchestral music is, there's nothing else that it's supporting. So the intent is different. And also in much of classical music, I mean, the vast majority of classical music was written pre anything visual. So one of the things in which I did a lot of work for symphony orchestras, where I created sort of theatrical shows for them. And I got a lot of pleasure out of reading audience accounts of hearing whatever, Beethoven's Fifth or something like that. And the way in which people listened back then is very, very different than the way people listen now. There was no such thing as just music in the background. That is to say radios and stuff like that. They were very active listeners. So they would go, "Oh, I felt this." And they're crying, talking about how they cried through sections. It's just a very different audience than what we have today.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Cause I was raised on obviously movie soundtracks and things like that. Of course, my classical music information comes from Bugs Bunny cartoons. I think that's the old Seinfeld line too, but
yeah, really.
You do listen to things different. I almost listen visually, even to classical, Beethoven, things like that. So it's interesting that you point that out.
Yeah. One of the things that which, because I just pulled the Fifth out and then I realized, when Beethoven did the Fifth, the first presentation of the Fifth, it was quite a night. It was he also presented, I think it was Piano Concerto No. 4, a bunch of choral renditions, a couple of sonatas. It was 4 hours of Beethoven. They had, people would say, there are going to be 45 musicians on the stage. This was the largest orchestras that they had ever heard, except for thunder and cannon fire. The volume of sound with 45 people on stage had not been heard ever. So it just shows you how kind of naive we were and how early on this was taking place. Now, it's big, 100, 100 people in the band and what have you. But it's back then, these were things to come and see, and to listen to. Oh, my God, the volume. That was the event.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you're basically putting on almost a movie. I guess at the time it was visual, I'll do that now. Well, my wife and I will go see an orchestra, and we'll just watch. I mean, she plays violin too, so we kind of like look at the different musicians and kind of pinpoint, especially the conductor, especially when they get into it. It's just fun stuff. But for you, when did the interest in performing start? So you're a sci-fi kid, music, so when did acting
Well, I had the distinction of flunking a couple of times. So I
high school
again. Junior high school.
Okay.
Sixth grade, and the problem was that I couldn't read, and so I went to this little school, little private school, kind of end of the road, and I had a wonderful teacher. There was a wonderful teacher there, and for all of us. And he used to come in. My class was 19 kids. I mean, in the entire graduating class. So he would come in and he'd say, you know, we're going to do Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. Well, we didn't know what he was talking about, but he would make us learn Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, and his wife would play the piano and he would direct it and we would do it. Christmas is coming around. We're going to do Handel's Messiah, and, you know, and we're all up there doing it. Well, springtime came about and he said, we're going to do Henry V, and Delancey, you're going to play Hal. And so I did. I had 2 months. I learned my part with great difficulty, and because I had a really hard time reading it, and I did it, and out under the trees. And a man had come to see his granddaughter, and he happened to be the editor of the Pelican Shakespeares. The school editions of the Shakespeare plays. And he took my father aside and he said, if your son has an interest, you should encourage him because he has a flair for this.
Wow.
And so for me at the age of whatever that was, 14, it was the first time I had ever been good at anything in school. And so I sort of grabbed hold of that as if it were a life preserver.
Yeah. That's the thing. That's people always say, encourage a kid, and man, they'll just latch onto it.
Right.
Okay. So do you get into school plays? Are you, college, are you taking acting classes? Because you ended up at Juilliard, right?
Right. I mean, it's at this little school, by the time I graduated, I had done Henry V, Romeo and Juliet, 12th Night, and Hamlet.
Wow. So you knew this was it.
Well, I mean, I did them every year. And yeah, so then I went to college and just continued doing it. I was under the false impression that I was just going to keep on doing Shakespeare from then on. Of course, that was within a matter of a couple of hours that was beaten out of me. So I have been acting since I was 14.
Okay. And so eventual move to the West Coast, I'm guessing you got a contract with Universal?
I did. I graduated from Juilliard, and then I went to the American Shakespeare Festival up in Connecticut, and then back into the city, and I took a couple of auditions, and I got a movie, and it was so different than anything that I had been doing that I thought, why not? And so I came out here to Los Angeles, and I was put under contract. And I worked for I did a lot of shows in that period of time. I did.
You did?
Shows.
Okay. Here's the thing. A few weeks back, I interviewed writer Stephen D'Souza. We talked about his $6 Million Man episodes. I'm doing homework for the interview, as I usually do. I'm watching the episodes Death Probe. And all of a sudden, Q pops up right in the middle of it.
Yeah, right.
And next thing I know, I'm like, whoa, he's in like four episodes.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in the world of $6 Million Man?
I was under contract, and they, here, go over there, do it. I was terrified.
Just like that was the job that week. It's like, okay, six. But did you know, because you're a sci-fi kid, like, did you know, because they're season five, I think, at this point. So it's a huge phenomenon at that point.
Yeah, but that's not the sort of the sci-fi that ever interested me. I just was not that type of it. It's too soft. I really like white knuckle, hard boiled sci-fi.
Death Probe wasn't enough for you.
No, it wasn't enough.
Sharks
for me.
Swimming with sharks.
For the most part, I did these things, never watched them. Maybe I should have, probably would have made my acting better, but I couldn't.
Okay, so you never watched them? You did not call them back home? Like,
No.
Mom, Dad, I'm in six million dollars. Okay, all right, fair enough.
No, they couldn't care less.
Okay, fair enough. So,
and then after 2 years, I went back into the theater. I went up to Seattle and worked up there for a year.
Okay. Lee Majors, a cool dude?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is what he said to me. I said, because, you know, I came from whatever it was, you know, 10 years of being in plays. So you rehearse for 3 weeks or 4 weeks, and then, you know, you're ready to show. Here it was absolutely, I arrived and he goes, I don't have any lines. He says to the first, so why don't we just go ahead and shoot this? I go, well, I have lines. I was like, well, we don't need a rehearsal. You just say your lines. I go, yeah. Oh my God. I go, this is my first job. I've never done this before. And he goes, then you'll never forget me.
Only Major said that.
Yeah.
Nice. And you haven't.
Yeah. No, that's true. Personal. I will never. And I saw him, I don't know, 10 years ago. I told him that story. He thought it was funny.
That is funny.
Yeah. Ha ha.
Okay. In addition to Stephen D'Souza, I also interviewed the great actress Arlene Sorkin, your daytime drama wife. She did tell me a few tales out of school. You ready for this?
Uh-huh.
Okay. She mentioned walking into your dressing room. And you tend to go to the bathroom with the door wide open?
Well, I'm the only one in the room.
Not expecting her to come in and run lines with you? All right, fair enough.
I'm waiting for the story. Is that it?
Well, that was one that she said that she had to say that you weren't really married, that you need to shut the door when you're in the bathroom. She also told a story about you wanting her to sneak out of work to go see a movie. It was at a dollar theater, and I quote her, she said, because you are very economical.
Oh, God. What we did is that we went to see Alien.
That's the movie, yes. So you do remember
that's the movie.
Okay.
And it
but you should have been at work.
We should have been at work. We went to the Dome. Actually, this is a very funny story.
So it's not a dollar movie.
It's not a dollar movie.
Okay.
We went to the Dome. And to see it. And we already knew that we were doing something that was very naughty. But, you know, okay. But what we didn't figure on is that it's a really long movie.
Yeah.
Okay? So in any case, we are there, and it's like 11:30 or something like that.
In the morning. Yeah, you should be at work.
In the morning. Mm-hmm. And or maybe it was even a little later than that, because we had to be back for...
She said you got back to the studio late.
Yeah. Okay. For dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
So in any case, we're watching the thing and whatever, you know, an hour and 30 minutes in, she goes, we've got to go. We've got to go. I said, no. We're fine. We've got to go. We're fine. This is the best part of the movie. I'm not leaving. And she got up and she, I'm leaving. And she walked outside. But I'm thinking, she's not going anywhere. I'm the one who drove. So she'll be back. And so there are very few people in this theater right now, okay? And just she does come back, and it's the first time that we see the monster full out, the head full out, okay? It's that wonderful scene. You finally go like that. Well, she has walked up behind me, and just as the monster comes out, she slams her hand down on my shoulder, except it's not me. She, in the dark, she picked the wrong guy.
It's another dude.
And he screams. Screams. I'm like, I'm turning around going, what's going on? And then, so that's, we in fact got to see the entire movie, and we got back sort of in time.
And you kept your jobs, which is good.
We kept
She also wants me to ask you about an incident about a car that you may or may not have swindled her out of.
Oh.
And that's all she told me about that. She refused to tell me anymore.
Oh, my God. I can't believe that she's still seeing a guy came to her and said, she came to me, and because I know cars well, she came to me with an old Jaguar, and she said, what do you think? And I said, I don't think you should buy this. But I bought it.
Did you intentionally tell her not to buy it so that you could buy it?
I just knew, you know, this is a Jaguar when Lucas was still making it, and it was just like, you know, there are electrical problems. I was like, this is not a car for Arlene. Truly not a car for Arlene.
I don't know if I'm buying your side of this.
And then I went, oh, you know, actually, I can buy it. Of course, I had trouble with it, but the fact is that I can also fix the most of the trouble.
But you could have fixed it for her.
Oh, no, I'm not really kidding.
You are Q. You are Q across town. Yeah, that's method acting right there.
Across town every couple of weeks.
Yeah,
see why the.
All right, no, you are method acting with Q. Look, I discussed with Arlene how her Days of Our Lives role led to her role as Harley Quinn, Batman writer Paul Dini. He was home watching the soaps, saw her, realized that's the girl I went to college with, called her Harley Quinn. Rest is history. Would you tell our listeners how Days of Our Lives led to the Q Continuum?
Oh, well, I went down into the basement into my time machine to disappear, and I showed up on some. So many people have actually, seriously said to me, is it when you went down to the basement into your time machine, is that how you got over to Star Trek? Yeah, that's exactly how it happened. I left Days, and I had a great time, but I knew that I didn't want to stay on it forever. And I saved my money, which is what Arlene has alluded to about dollar movies. And then I just went back out into the world, and I was doing, I was doing a play down at the Taper called Terra Nova when I got a call from my agent saying, you have an audition tomorrow at 4:30 or whatever it is up at Paramount I don't know. It must be a typo. It's just a letter Q here.
And didn't say Star Trek?
Yeah, it said Star Trek.
Okay. Yeah, Star Trek, just the letter Q. Wow.
Right. And I said, Star Trek? I mean, didn't they? They've already done Star Trek. And she goes, yeah, I don't know. They're doing it again. I said, but I'm in a play. I mean, I can't just walk away. She said, well, try to, you know, John, this is the story. Well, I didn't go to that audition. A week later, she called me up and she said, you know, the producer says the producer called, he's asked for you. And I said, you know, look, I'm in a play. I can't just watch. I said, if you can make it at lunchtime, that would be there. And she said, I'll do that. Let me see what I can do. And I arrived there and I auditioned. And when I walked out, this tall guy, big guy, and you know, I'm 6'3", so he was certainly as tall as I am, and if not larger. And he said, put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, you make my words sound better than they are. And I said, well, you must be the writer. And he said, I'm Gene Roddenberry. And I had no idea who that was. And he said, we're going to see more of you. And I thought, oh, God, how many times I've heard that one. And I said, well, thanks a lot.
Did he introduce himself as Gene Roddenberry?
Yeah.
And you had that just didn't even send up a red flag?
It didn't.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Okay.
And then I went for the door, and this other guy comes in. He says,
who was the other guy?
Leonard Mazelish. He came to me and he said, I'm the producer who's been asking for you. He actually wasn't even a producer, he was Gene's lawyer. He said, okay. This is a payback. You're here as a payback. I go, what are you talking about? He said, about 4 years ago, I was flat on my back in the hospital with a quadruple bypass operation. And I knew where he was going at this point. Mm-hmm. And every day at 1 o'clock, you made me, and he's talking about the soap with Arlene and I, you made me laugh when I thought I was going to die. And I decided at that point that if I ever had an opportunity, I would get you in on something. So that's how I got Star Trek.
I love that story. I absolutely love that story. And 30 years. 30 years. Wow.
Yeah. And even that did not cinch it, because he said, they're going to hire you. Now, for the first time, I'm asking, well, when does this start? And he gave me the date. And I said, you know, I can't do it because I'm doing this show. And then we go to Japan. And he said, well, get out of this. This will be far more important to you. And I said, well, so in 6 weeks from now, this is supposed to shoot. And he said, yes. I said, well, if I get out of the show, the play that I'm in, to do your show, what if a better offer comes in between in the next 6 weeks? So I do the same thing for you, do you? And he said, I'll tell you what, we're going to figure something out. And they did. They figured out a way. I was supposed to work for the month, you know, a couple of days here, a couple of days there. So what they said to my agent is that we will slide hit it. I understand something. It meant I lost money because they didn't pay me. We will need him for the last 2 weeks of the month shoot, but he has to be there on Monday, whatever the date was, you know, the 18th or whatever it was. And now for the first time, I'm looking at my schedule really closely and I go, oh my God, I've got a matinee performance on Sunday.
Yeah. Cause theaters go dark on Monday.
In Tokyo.
Oh, in Tokyo.
So I went, well, that's it. It's not going to happen. And
it's not in San Bernardino.
Yeah. And I got off the phone and I told my wife, I said, well, it's not gonna, and she said, well, international dateline. And lo and behold, we came down at, I don't know, whatever it was, 3:30. I got on a plane at 6 o'clock on Sunday in Tokyo. And I got back to Los Angeles at like 11 o'clock at night on Friday, on Saturday night. And I was on the set at 6 in the morning on Monday. And that's how I got Star Trek.
That's fantastic.
Those are all the pieces that came together.
That's fantastic. Do you recall your audition scene?
I sung and I did it and I juggled.
Oh, you just did like some performance art.
I'm teasing.
You got me.
No, I have.
You did get me there.
I don't recall.
Okay. I didn't know if it was like they actually gave you something for the character that you could feed off of, or if they said, you know, this is like an omnipotent being or anything like that. So.
Well, I was already playing sort of an omnipotent being in the fact that I was playing Raoul Amundsen. Because Terra Nova was about the conquest of Antarctica. So I was already sort of, that was in my bones already. And combined with my natural artillery, I was able to pull it off.
There's the method. There. How was the character explained? So you hit the ground running Monday morning, whenever it is. You're shooting Encounter at Farpoint. How is the character explained to you? What do you channel? Because, you know, a lot of times, especially when you're, I don't know if you know, it's a villain. I mean, he's kind of a villain. He's kind of not. You know, actors always go, well, you got to, if you're going for a villain, you got to find the humanity. You got to find, like, his motivations. They're not all villains. But Q's on a different level. Where do you go to find some inspiration for this character? Other than the method, the Delancey method.
You mean other
just
than
being a jerk to people? Yeah.
To Jim Beam and Jack Daniels and you know, those other acting coaches.
Are you lit on that? You're not lit on that set.
What do you mean lit?
You said Jack Daniels and Jim Beam.
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, because that makes me watch that pilot episode in a whole different way then.
Yeah.
That would be so amazing.
No, I don't know. I mean, you know, I it's a guy who does what he wants to do. You know, there's no, you know, it's full out, not constrained by the truth. I didn't really think about it very much. I didn't go, in retrospect over the years, you know, I could say, well, there was another character I played, which was Lord Byron, mad, bad, dangerous to know. I could say, well, I knew some of that, but it was not a calculated thing. I think also part of it is that I had just the way in which I feel one should be acting, or at least it's been helpful to me, is that you kind of load everything up into RAM. That is all of your homework. It's all up there. And if you think of them as tools that are available, you're not quite sure which tool you're going to use or which multiple tools you're going to use, but they're all sort of kind of ready to go. So there's no question that the sense of humor and stuff like that, if Patrick had been, you know, Mr. Chuckles, I would probably have gone in the other direction. But because that was the side of the pie that was not being eaten, I could see, I need to undercut. I need to find humor and sarcasm and be constantly poking and tweaking kind of, you know, I'm the captain. I need to be the captain here. And you can easily poke fun at that. So you don't know. You know, you just don't know until you get to the set and you start playing. But if you have these tools that are sort of available, you could go in this direction. Then you don't have to be in your head. You're not coming there to just perform your homework Frasier said, you know, all of that homework goes out the, was it Frasier or Tyson? Mike Tyson said, all that homework goes out the window after you get punched in the first time you get punched in the face. You know, you're kind of like, whoa!
Then you're in the moment.
Then you're in the moment. So, that's what you do.
Well, you referenced it, and as you watch the progression of the episodes too, and I've just done this recently too, you see that play between yourself and Patrick Stewart, just almost amping up with each episode. Did you have conversations with him off camera to like how the dynamic would play out, or he's going to do this, so why don't I do this? Or what were the conversations like between you and Patrick Stewart?
Well, not too much. I mean, the fact is that we were combatants, you know, so we didn't really spend much time talking about how we were going to combat. That would be counterproductive, actually. So I didn't really spend very much time. Frakes used to say, you are our litmus test. For the next generation, I did 6 episodes for them. So every time I came in, which was usually once a year, missing 1 year, he would say, what do you see now? Well, what do you see? So, you know, we would sit outside and I would go, well, I don't know, the relationships between these people and what's going on here and stuff like that. As the show went from, oh my God, are we really doing this? And is this going to be successful? Where the first year was a little dicey about that. I was told, and I don't know if it was Gene who told me this, but, I know who it was. Michael Piller said, I don't think we would have had the success that we had if the show had not been pre-bought for two seasons.
Right.
Because it just took them that amount of time to find their legs.
Were you watching it? Because you pop in every season except for season five. Were you watching the show as it went along, or just
occasionally?
Okay, so you got a sense of what was going on, sort of, with the characters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. Yeah.
When did you first know that your character would bookend the series?
Oh, not until they said we'd like you to do the last episode.
Oh, season seven.
Yeah.
Wow. So you had no idea that they were going to wrap it full circle.
Every time I did an episode, as far as I was concerned, that was my last episode.
Wow. Okay.
I never asked people about it. You know, it's sort of like asking if you're going to be invited to somebody's dinner party. You just don't do it. You know, I went on my merry way and I did other stuff. And if they called, that was great. And if they didn't, I was like, oh, too bad.
I mentioned in the intro that in my opinion, the Q is the greatest adversary of the Next Gen crew. Do you see him that way?
Of course.
Okay.
Yes, although I don't know if others, you feel that way.
No, seriously. I mean, just looking at you, I mean, you know enough of the series. I mean, you got Ferengi, Romulan, I mean, all these Borg, you know, but it's Q, right?
Right.
The reason I ask is, like, were there ever any discussions about you being in one of the features?
If there were, I don't know anything about them. Mm. I've been left with that there were people who wanted me in them and others who didn't. So, you know, I mean,
what does that mean?
Well, I think the argument is that they become Q episodes. And so do you want to do an entire feature that's actually a Q episode, a Q feature? I guess that was at least how I was explained as being, you know, okay. Roddenberry, Gene said to me after a week or so, he said, you know, we're going to want you to come back maybe 6 to 7, 8 times a year. I went, oh, well, that's great. You know, what you kind of, okay. And then after the second or third, or, you know, whatever, you know, many months later, I saw him and he said, you know, we couldn't really do that. I said, okay. I stay sort of passive about it because there isn't anything that I'm going to say that's going to change anything. But he said, my problem is this, and is that I have to build up our main characters. And the problem is that to bring this character in so often, it becomes kind of, you know, you're waiting for Mercutio to come in all the time. Mm-hmm. And having done Romeo and Juliet twice as Romeo, it's excruciating when Mercutio dies because everybody's like, oh, we have to deal with Romeo now. You know, the audience goes. And because Mercutio's just the fun guy. And so I understood what he was saying. I went, yeah, well, that makes sense to me.
A little cue goes a long way.
I think so. And, you know, this is a little bit along the lines of the Marx Brothers. You know, we think of every movie that they did as being this masterpiece. Well, that's not true at all. But it's just that they did so few of them. Hmm. You know, we go, oh, I like that. Well, you know, people go, oh, the Q episodes, they're all fantastic and stuff like that. Well, I don't really agree. I think there are two or three of them that are really good, and the rest of them are like, okay, they're okay.
Well, you walked me right into it. 30th anniversary. Do you mind if we talk about a couple of these? Maybe your favorite ones?
Yeah, of course.
I'm looking at Q Who. Look, it's the Borg take center stage in this episode, but my goodness, you had to realize you were part of a pivotal episode, if not then, at least now, for not only the franchise, not only the series, but the franchise itself, into the movies, everything. just your immediate thoughts on that episode itself.
I was very happy to introduce the crew to my friends, the Borg.
You just put chills on the back of my neck when you just did that. That you actually did. That was kind of creepy.
You guys will really like each other.
Yeah, they did. But there's also Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan in it. And it's like this, and it plays out for a couple episodes and then it goes away. Was there ever a thought that maybe they would explore this sort of relationship between Q and Guinan?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, again, that's one of these things. It's a funny acting thing. And that is that usually comes out of that scene that we did where we're both going, you know.
She's whatever, got the hands up and you've got, yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. That was, I'd like to think of it as being this. As actors, we understood, or at least I understood, and I'm sure she did too, that scene, that particular scene was sort of a bumpy ride. It was not a great scene. So then the issue is how do you get through it? What's the smoke and mirrors that you're going to throw? Well, that was such an obvious smoke and mirror. Ooh, like a little diversion. Cut. Okay, scene's over. We're like, phew, got through that one. We're good. Never really to be thought about until the audience sees it. And this is how it happens oftentimes. The audience sees it and creates something out of it. And I don't think that they actually had anything in their heads any more than I don't think that they had anything in their heads when Gene created the character of Q. It was, he wanted to go right into episodic. The studio didn't. They argued endlessly about it. He, I think, was probably paid a lot of money to get him to write, you know, add another, whatever, 40 minutes, 43 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, he was padding the pilot.
And you can see a very jagged seam through that encounter at Farpoint called trying to merge, you know, integrate two stories, which were never written as integrate two stories into one, which, you know, a movie which was never written as a single story. And I don't think, I think that he, it was years later that somebody said to me, or years later, well, actually it was two or three years later, somebody said, gee, this is really like Trelane. I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. So they sent me a tape of Trelane that this fan did, and I looked at it and I went, oh, very interesting. Well, now I can begin to piece some stuff together, which I'd never asked Gene, but at least knowing how things work, and that is that he sits down in front of an empty page and he goes, oh, I have to write another 43 pages. So let me think now, what are the characters that have worked out really well in the past? Well, he remembers this character, either consciously or subconsciously, and then creates this sort of a derivative character from that, which is Q. And it just goes on. Was that character going to be going through all of this, you know, the different episodes? No. At that point, you know, an actor comes in, turns it into a three-dimensional character, still one could go, well, okay, but that's a one shot. And then the audience sees it and goes, oh, we really like that character. And then they who are going, oh man, we're throwing everything against the wall here to try to keep the series going. Well, let's bring back that Q character. And I think things were as, or, and usually they are as, I don't want to say superficial, but they're not really much more motivated than what I just said.
No, and it's funny you mention that too, because he did that with the Naked Now, episode 3, season 1. That was a sort of a sequel to original series episode 2. So, it's like you said, you kind of bring back what works. Speaking of Naked,
yes,
Deja Q.
Right.
Quite the memorable entrance in this episode. What were your thoughts when you first saw the script and realized you were probably not going to need wardrobe fittings for your first scene?
Not to, you know, except unless you're a bodybuilder, you kind of go, oh my God, really? Do I have to?
Were you in were you okay with your shape at that point, or did you hit the gym for a few weeks?
No, listen, I might have cranked on about it, but I didn't hit the gym for a few weeks, that's for sure. No, it's just the way it is. And I had a jock strap on, so they were having real difficulties. I was up on a wooden board, laying, you know, supposedly reclining in a suggestive manner on a wooden board, between two A-frame ladders. So you can imagine how comfortable that was, with a jock strap on, I was going, can we shoot this? And they were fiddle farting around trying to get a figure shot. And I go, what is the problem? What is the problem? What is the problem? They're going, well, the jock strap is the indent. And you know, well, I just jumped off the board and I said, listen, those of you who want to stay, stay. And those who want to leave, leave. But I pulled the jock strap off and got back up on the board, and we shot that really quickly at that point.
Committed to your craft.
Committed to just moving on.
The king who would be man, right?
Well, and because I actually do remember that was a Wednesday. I know, you know, one would never remember these things except that one has been asked. It's like these episodes and is frozen in time, 30 years ago, been frozen in time. So in any case, it was Thanksgiving was the next day. And we had to stop at midnight. And I knew the last scene was the mariachi band. And I had a lot of big speeches in between. And what you don't want to have happen, or at least I don't want to have happen, is that all of these gags, you know, mariachi and the floating in midair naked, they're all gags. The work, the acting are these scenes and speeches and what have you. And I didn't want us to get so behind in time that they would go, okay, great, cut. Did he say all the words? Okay, great, moving on. And you go, no, I only got one shot at that. So I was looking to keep things moving.
The cast and crew must have loved when it was Q week or weeks, because you have things like that. You have Robin Hood, Cupid, because they're probably so used to just being in those Starfleet uniforms, and all of a sudden they get to play Robin Hood.
Yeah, I think so. It was fun. I forget the director's name. He was a very nice guy, man. I liked him. I did another show with him, Mission Impossible. Somebody who really knew his business, and you know, it was fun.
For actors, I think you probably get in a rut, and then all of a sudden it's like you do a Western, because they did Westerns. You know, you get those weeks where it's like, okay, we're going to go crazy with this. Q, they just had to go, okay, we're just going to open up here.
René Aubergenois said, he was explaining, we were at a party or at his house, and he said, this is John, and he plays, and he goes, oh, Q, what sort of character is that? And René said, John plays a very unusual character, or something. And he said, when Q comes, it's like having Pavarotti arrive. on the set.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's the highest praise. For the season finale, the series finale, did you go back and rewatch the first episode?
No. But I did. There, I really did spend some time thinking about what are the facets of this stone that have been cut in the previous six episodes, and what is there in the previous five episodes, and what is there to be left to be cut now. And so I looked at these scenes in the season finale or the show finale as an opportunity to bring something new or to polish up a particular point of view facet that I, you know, that I thought would be important. I mean, there a lot of attention was put on that.
What was the mood on the set? Just knowing that they were wrapping things up. I know Marina Sirtis has said that was just almost traumatic for her when they were wrapping things up.
I think people were, I mean, it was one of those hugely bittersweet experiences. I did not have that experience because, again, I only did six of those six episodes. I know that there was a lot of tension. People were exhausted and also very emotional. And there was a lot of attention coming. You can tell, you know, when you get on a set, you know, certain sets are a few sets are very different than the bulk of what television work is. Breaking Bad was a very different set. Star Trek became a very different set of, you know, where people go, wow, we're doing something that a lot of people are watching and this means something. So everybody was at the top of their game. And certainly the last show was that way. The last episode was that way.
You're a multi-talented individual, writer as well. Comic book and novel stories. You got IQ, co-written with the great Peter David. We talk comic book world. You got a chance to write a Q story, The Gift, in Star Trek The Next Generation, annual number one. Do you have some more Q stories in you?
Well, you know where I'm placing? I just got off the phone. I had a writer's meeting this morning with Timelines. You know what Timelines is?
Is this the start, the video game?
Yes.
Or the interactive?
The mobile app. Yeah. So I'm working with a woman named Jessica Slawinski, and she's a wonderful, wonderful writer. I just, the amount of work that she does is just amazing to me. And so we talk quite a bit about strategy. We talk a lot of plotting. When I first got this assignment, it was really to just kind of be the front man. And I said, you know, it doesn't interest. I mean, I can do that. I've done it before, but I would be more interested to also get involved in some of the other things. And I said, sure, go ahead. Off you go. So she and I worked quite a bit. And one of the things in which I said to her, how is it that video games are written? And she goes, well, it's pretty much the seat of your pants. You know, it's just, you're just trying to keep your head above water and pump this stuff out. I said, well, you know, why don't we apply what I learned when I was on soap opera? And that is that I asked Corday how it was that they could write for 365 days out of the year. And it was explained to me that, you know, I love the way it was explained. She goes, well, you have an A, B, and a C story. So just imagine taking the A story and unrolling a roll of toilet paper and and writing it all on, that's all your A, and then you do that for the B and the C. Then you roll it all back up again, and then every day you take out, we're going to do two sheets of A and one sheet of B and three sheets of C. So I said, why don't we do that? So we worked for about a month, and we created a story that went ahead, a narrative story that gave us a year. Now, at least in the process, you understand what your spine is, what the ribs that go into the spine, which are separate stories of their own. You understand what the theme is, what the super objective is. You apply all the writing principles and acting principles and what have you to this narrative, to creating this narrative, so that even though I haven't they went off and, you know, did other things, creating events and what have you. We talked today. I hadn't talked to her for a couple of months because I was in out of country. And we could go back to the foundational work that we did 2 years ago. Okay, we know what the spine is. And we were able to answer a lot of things. And this is all a long way of saying the big thing that we want to get into, which we have already, and it's all plotted out, and no one has done yet, is the continuum.
I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, I wasn't sure how to breach into that because I know there have been books done on the continuum. But it's almost, correct me if I'm wrong, we still don't know everything it's about, right?
Well, certainly don't know everything. And we know very little about what it's about.
I mean, we know, like you and your son, Keegan, like we know there's like a Q Jr. running around and like Q's hanging out with Q Jr. And,
right.
You know, we know Q's still, you know, in the comic book world, he still, you know, he brings Picard's brother back to life and, you know, that whole thing. But like, we don't, there's this whole backstory of the Q. So is this going to flesh that out?
Yes. And I can't really tell you what it is.
Okay.
Because then I would give away, you know.
Yeah, why pay for it?
all the work and
tell me everything.
What's the point of doing it? Yeah.
When are we going to know about this? When can we see it?
Well, the thing is that I don't know. I mean, that was part of our discussion that when, you know, hey, Jessica, when are we going to, she said, I know. I want to get to that. But what we're doing now is that we're going through what we're calling events, which are 1 month events. And I said, well, okay, so let's talk about these 1 month events and let's talk about how they're organized. And we can, it can still all lead back to the spine, which ultimately leads to the journey into the continuum. So we're
nice.
Still okay.
Nice.
We're still okay.
We got Star Trek Discovery, a new series coming out. Obviously, the feature films, they're doing gangbusters at the box office. Any chance we're going to see you pop up on screen in one of these?
You mean like geriatric Q?
No, well, we've seen geriatric Q in all good things. That's the cool thing about Q is that he kind of like matches Picard's age, wherever he's at. So if he's like, you know, geriatric Picard, we got geriatric Q. I think he just likes to appear to Picard as that, but even in a different character, would you be interested in just popping up as a different character? They always bring Star Trek actors back.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, sure.
Or is it once you've played again, Q, it's like, how can you top Q?
What else can I play?
I know.
Certainly half the audience in the world thinks that.
I know. So, be like, hey, it's Q. Yeah. I know. You'll keep thinking it's
yeah.
Q.
Voiceover
work. More voiceover work. You're Brainiac now. We're loving you as Brainiac.
Oh, cool.
More voiceover work on the way?
Let's see. StarCraft. I play a character called Alarak. I keep on saying to the people there at Blizzard, I think it is. I said, you know, this character has a real anger management problem. wouldn't it be great if this guy who's, you know, everything is like this, you know, I'm going to kill you know, all this type of stuff. I said, you ought to create a scene where you just see Alarak alone, kind of just chilling and it's just him and his watercolors.
Yeah. Oh, Pretty Little Clouds.
Yeah, he just paints watercolors and trees and unicorns or something.
Give your voice a rest. You mentioned traveling. You are a world traveler. You're bouncing all around. We got comic conventions coming up. People can check out Q.
Yeah. Oh, and My Little Pony. You didn't even talk about that.
I know, My Little Pony. I know that's a little bit outside my wheelhouse, but what you have the documentary? Is it the Bronies?
Yeah, but I mean, it's just amazing how popular that's become.
Is it bigger than Trek, or is it about equal with Trek?
You mean for people coming to see me?
Yeah, and like the whole My Little Pony universe.
It's Yeah, no, it's not. It's okay. Not the equal to Trek.
But, okay, I don't know. It's outside my wheelhouse. Seems, so.
Yeah. okay, go ahead.
No, good. No, tell me about it. Do you get more My Little Pony coming up?
No. Oh, yes, I do. Okay. I don't know if you've ever, have you seen any of them?
I have. I'm not a brony. Full disclosure, I'm not a brony, but I do love me some.
Yeah.
But tell me, inform me, teach me.
Yeah, what am I missing? What I think is so interesting about them, and I don't watch them either. I watch occasionally something, so that is that they provide a secular morality to a very secular young part of our population, which is not unlike what Star Trek did. They were morality tales. And, didactic, shows. And so these things are the same. And I just found the comparison to be interesting.
And you got more voiceover work in that world coming up?
I do. I do.
Well, there you go. All the convention appearances, I'm guessing everything's going to be, we can find out at Delancey.com. That's like the online hub for all things Delancey.
You know what? I know I have a website, but I've never actually. I don't think I've ever looked at it.
You don't watch your own stuff. That's not shocking.
I don't watch. I know. I am terrible about that.
But you're on social media, Facebook, Twitter. Where are you at?
I don't do the Twitter anymore. After it, Twitter, which I was never too fond of, has been given such a bad name of late that I just cannot possibly go and tweet anything.
It's lost its luster.
It's lost its luster. Every time I hear the word tweet or Twitter, I go.
We're going to have to get Q on this. We're going to have to get Q
and
on this.
And as somebody who actually is a student of history, reads every day political news and what's going on and what have you, the fact that we're getting information on that way, it just kills me.
It's a whole different world. It's a whole different world. Look, this is we're maybe in the 24th century before we knew it. How do we find out where you're going to be? How do we know where you're going to be at a Trek convention or come up and shake your hand and sign some stuff?
I can't even tell you. I don't know how you're going to find that out.
You can tell me, and then I'll tell everybody.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'll do.
That's what's going to happen.
I'm going to be at Trader Joe's tomorrow between 11 and 12. I'm going to be in the frozen food section.
Will you bag my groceries at Trader Joe's?
I'll bag your groceries.
I want to hear.
I'll sign your grocery bag.
Continued success. Safe travels. I know you're going all over the world, you and your wife. It's your family. Safe travels on that. Thank you for taking the time today to celebrate 30 years of Star Trek The Next Generation. That was fun.
You're quite welcome. Thank you very much for calling.
I think the sci-fi movie that John was referring to early in that interview was 1953's Invaders from Mars. Full disclosure, I am not up as I should be on my 50 sci-fi flicks. I've seen some of them. I enjoyed the ones I've seen, but I haven't seen a lot of the classics. That's definitely not one I've seen, but considered added to the queue, right? Hey, added to the queue. Queue recommendation from Q. What could be better, right? Huge thanks to John Delancey for stopping by today. Had some fun celebrating Next Gen's 30th with him. Working on some more Next Gen interviews in the weeks and months ahead. So be sure to stay tuned to Comic Book Central for those. I'm going to be talking about the show for the rest of the year. It's one of my faves. Of course, if you're new to the show, you definitely want to check out my past Next Gen talks with Jonathan Frakes, Marina Sirtis, Brent Spiner, Michael Dorn. They've all been here. Now, hey, even original series trekkers William Shatner and Nichelle Nichols. The Legends, they've stopped by the lair as well. All those classic conversations, they can be found in the episode archive at the website comicbookcentral.net. They're all there. If you go on the Facebook page in the About section, there's an episode guide, so you can go right to them. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes. If you're liking what you're hearing, I really hope you are. Please be so kind as to rate and review the show in iTunes. Blueberry, Stitcher, all the episodes can be found on those services as well. So the Lair's out there, the Lair's everywhere. And don't forget to share the Lair each and every week. Share the Facebook episode post, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Don't forget the network. Retweet those posts on Twitter, @comicbookctrl. That gets the word out, gets the show out to so many more listeners. And be sure to drop me a line. Let me know what's on your mind. joe@comicbookcentral.net, or you can click the Signal Me tab on the website. If you're on the website, again, comicbookcentral.net, be sure to check out the show notes for this episode. Links to John DeLancey on social media, they're going to be there. Even though he says he's not on there much, you never know when he's going to drop by, right? So those will be there. You can follow him all over social media. Also, the links for the Mystery Science Theater 3000 tour, the Mads Are Back tour, how you get those tickets, all those links are going to be in the show notes as well, so there's going to be a lot of information out there. If you're going to those Columbus, Ohio shows, be sure to say hi if you see me there. Definitely write in or leave a voicemail message at the website. Tell me what you thought of the shows. I'll play it here. I'll read it. These should be amazing, man. Those are going to be some fun shows. All right, well, Q might be able to break the rules of time and space, but I unfortunately cannot. I am out of time for today. But I shall return to the cozy confines of the Lair in a very short period of time, because next week on Comic Book Central, hey, here's a headline for you folks, Lois Lane in the Lair. That's right, the multiple Emmy-winning actress who is also the voice of none other than intrepid reporter Lois Lane in the DC Animated Universe, the magnificent actress, one of my all-time faves, Dana Delaney. She's going to be stopping by next week. That's right, she's going to be here. We're not only going to talk about Superman and Lois Lane, we're going to be talking about Batman, Mask of the Phantasm, also Magnum P.I., Moonlighting. Yep, we're going to be going all over the place. So much more we're going to be talking about. We'll be here. You, of course, will be here as well. Until then, just like we were told in 50s sci-fi, keep watching the skies. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivations 3.0 imported license. All of the content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Au contraire, mon capitaine! He's back! I'm forgiven. My brothers and sisters of the continuum have taken me back. I'm immortal again. Omnipotent again.
Swell.